to me. When will I know I'd be insane to ever let that dirty game recapture me? And make me a shadow. All right, you're here with Books and Booze tonight. This is Renee. I am cracking a Scheinerbach beer that was left at my house. Jessica, I assume, is drinking rum and Coke. Dakota,
you're wrong.
I'm wrong. What's
your
wrong?
I've got Blue Moon, Honey Wheat Summer. Beer?
That's great because I almost had a Blue Moon.
I love Blue Moon.
So, and is it safe to assume that Dakota is drinking whiskey?
Actually, water tonight because college has stolen away all of my drinking time, unfortunately.
This is going to be a weird show. All right, so we're here with Gordon Hyland, author of Flashover, musician, man of many talents. What are you drinking tonight, Gordon?
I'm having our local brewery is called Boulevard here in Kansas City. That's the big one. And they also distribute to the Midwest and other areas as well that are fortunate to have it. But they have a specialty line that they started putting out a couple of years ago. And they come in these big 750 mil bottles that are like 10, 12% alcohol. And this one is called The Sixth Glass. And it's like it's a quadruple, like a Belgian style. It's very sweet. Has a huge head on it, and it's quite intoxicating. If you drink a bottle of that, you'll be walking a little funny.
That sounds awesome. I usually like to promote the local beers I'm drinking on the show, but I had a party, and everyone brought me beer for my birthday, so I'm just working through this 100-and-some-odd bottles of beer in my house right now.
Just like the song, right?
Yeah. Shiner's a good beer. Shiner's a good beer. Anyway, so we all got started on Flashover. I hate to admit that none of us actually finished it because it's been kind of a busy week for the show.
I can't believe you told him that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's better than him, like, asking, like, oh, how'd you like that part, and me being like,
I would have lied. Okay, we didn't finish it.
You guys aren't like Jon Stewart that has the, you know, his interns and production staff where they, you know, pre-qualify the book and flag some meaningful passages so he can pretend like he's read the whole thing, you know?
Exactly.
We don't have anything. I'm the tech guy, and I barely know how to turn on my computer. So
she's not even a guy.
And I'm not even a guy. So,
what a farce.
Yeah, we're
so, but about you.
Just wait till you get to the end. Oh, my God. God.
No, but I do feel comfortable saying that it's a good book. I haven't finished it, but I feel comfortable saying it's a good book. I'm eager to finish it. Well, one thing we were discussing in the pre-show meeting before you came on was it seems like there's a little bit of a theme in your writing dealing with Catholicism. Is it cool to ask you to talk about that, or is that like
unintentional?
I hadn't realized it, actually, until you mentioned it, but I'm thinking back to the other book, and yeah, I mentioned it in both books. I toned it back a lot in the current book. I'm what you would call a recovering Catholic. I grew up and I went to Sunday school. You know, I didn't go to, you know, parochial school, but every Sunday I would go. And my extended family is very religious and very conservative. And I just kind of come around college time, grew out of it, and was thinking more for myself and yada yada. And I'm not here to decry that one way or the other. But my first, my first book is told in first person, and a lot of it is me coming through. You know, there's about half of my personality kind of blended in there because you can't help that. People say that authors' first books are sort of like a laundry list of people that have wronged them and like a list of rants that they want to check off. And some of that is true. And I disguised a little bit of it, you know, here and there. The Catholicism in there, yeah, was when I was feeling a little bit more bitter about it. And Toby, the protagonist in that book, rants about it quite a bit more. The guy in the current book is not first person, it's third person. I tried to distance myself from things a lot more and not inject my personality very much, you know, as little as possible. So his views on it are actually probably more in line with mine, which are, I just don't care. You know, you believe what you want to believe. But in this case, Catholicism has given him some work and being able to do some contractor work on a church. So he's glad for that. You know, maybe not at least, you know, maybe not so much what goes on inside the sanctuary on Sundays, but he's glad to have church contacts. And, you know, it's a little more the priest who is sort of an ally of his in the story. I think helps it from being quite so negative, because this guy, he's a pretty good dude, and the priest is struggling with his own issues as well. But I think it's a less harsh take on Catholicism this time.
And you have a short story coming out called Purgatory?
Yes, that just launched on Wednesday of this week at a site called Solarside, S-O-L-A-R-C-I-D-E.
Yes, friends of the show. Dakota and Jessica are both featured in the Solarside anthology, Nova Parade, which is free for download on that same website, solarside.com. So we're big fans.
Awesome.
Yay.
We look for any opportunity to drop that in.
I've been hearing about it. I'm promoting it. I've been holding off on actually reading it because it's in PDF format right now, and I want to read it on my Kindle, and I know you can convert it or whatever, but I want to keep it, you know, as intact as possible. So I will be reading it with much anticipation as soon as that happens.
And there are some great names featured in that anthology, and we've been lucky enough to have a couple of those people on the show. And I know, now, speaking of people we've had on the show that are also in that anthology, is Andres Bergen mentioned that he was working on something that you were involved in, and I can't really remember the details because I'm woefully unprepared. But it's something to do with, like, a mix of graphic novel and short story. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm actually really excited about this because he wrote a novel called Tobacco Stained Mountain Goat, and he's working on he's already got a second one ready for publication in a couple months, I think. He gathered together some people. He solicited stories from folks with the theme of the anthology basically being the world, the universe that he created in that book, which is a near future dystopia that takes place in Melbourne, Australia, which is the last remaining city in the world. And it's sort of a microcosm of the current world, but post-apocalyptic. And, you know, like I said, near future. His book fuses sci-fi and noir. It's sort of a throwback to, like, Raymond Chandler and sort of 40s era noir, along with, like, some Blade Runner type elements. So he had this very detailed and very fully realized world that he wanted these stories to take place in, and these these graphic stories to take place in. And so I wrote up a story that's about a back alley surgeon who works out of his home. He does, like, nose jobs and boob jobs by day, but it's sort of a trope in the sci-fi world of the back alley surgeon. So he runs this business out of his home, and this gal comes by one day, and she wants an abortion, and those are way illegal by now, punishable by death, and he's struggling with the request. And that's my contribution.
And it sounds really exciting. I know we had already talked to you about being on the show when he brought it up and mentioned your name. And we were lucky enough, we got to read the second novel that's coming out in a couple months. We're really excited about anything that involves more than one of our guests. It makes us really happy to be able to link things in.
Yeah.
But you bring me to one of our – we solicited the internet for questions that people wanted us to ask you. And one of the questions was, WillStack70 from Twitter wanted to know if you felt that working on anthologies, and I'll add your other projects, your music and video production, gets in the way of writing your novels.
First of all, I appreciate you not adding the at sign when announcing the Twitter handle. I hate that on TV shows. We've got a question from at Will. It's like, we know, dude, it's Twitter. You don't. The at is just the technical thing. But Will, I appreciate the question. Thank you. Yeah, it is a distraction, as I've been early in my career focused on novels, which is kind of backwards of what a lot of people do. They go the short story route. They try to get some attention and prestige for those, and then they kind of work their way up to novels, so to speak. And when I first wrote a novel, to me, originally, it was just something to, like, check off a list of accomplishments, so to speak, and then I started taking it more and more seriously. So I'm kind of going backwards now. I'm going back to I'm taking several years off and doing nothing but, like, short stories and going back and working on music and just, like, short form stuff in general. But yeah, it is a distraction, and it was this time around because I had several invitations to be part of some anthologies, which I really appreciate because it means that they're not spec stories. Usually you write a story that you really like and you try to wedge it into a market someplace that aligns with your tastes and your abilities. But in these cases, I already knew, you know, hopefully I would make the cut, but I knew they were interested in my work. So I would tailor a story around whatever the anthology was. And historically the ones I've been a part of so far have been themed. And a lot of those have been in the last year or two. And there was Warmed and Bound, which is really exciting to be a part of, that was put out by the Velvet, which is a community that I'm a part of. And that was noir, largely noir, not all of it. But I don't really consider myself a noir writer. So I actually kind of buckled down and forced myself to kind of embody some of the themes that I was assuming other people would be writing about. And it helped me, you know, broaden my horizons a little bit. Same thing with the Tobacco Stained anthology that you mentioned, the Tobacco Stained Sky. I've never written a sci-fi story before. And so I was like, you know, I want to do this. So these people have been providing me opportunities to do things. It's sort of like an actor who gets invited to do cool movies. That's exciting. There was another anthology I was in that all the stories were based on, not Instagram, Hipstamatic photos taken around the Los Angeles area. And you would choose a photo and write a story about it. And it had to have a California theme. And that was really cool because it, you know, limitations are often freeing. You know, you're confined by this box that they put you in, and that forces you to open up other parts of your creativity and whatnot. So yes, they were distractions because I was kind of coming down the home stretch on the novel a little bit, and short stories. I'm an extremely slow writer. It takes me about 3 weeks usually to write a decent short story. But I really wanted to be a part of these things, and being someone who didn't have much of a short story oeuvre, so to speak, I wanted to take part in that. So I was happy to do so. It was a welcome distraction.
Was that that Los Angeles one you were talking about, was that Los Angeles in a Thousand Words? Was that?
Exactly. Yeah. In Search of a City, Los Angeles in a Thousand Words, and it's a photo picture book that you can get the ebook really cheap. I think it's like $2.99, $3.99, something like that, but the paperback was very expensive, I think prohibitively so for a lot of people, but it looks really nice on my shelf.
Ayla Villa was involved in that, though, right?
Has a story in it, and she was a contributor like everyone else, but she wasn't on
okay.
the editorials.
She was
the driving force behind Warmed and Bound, put in countless dozens and hundreds of hours on that thing. I mean, that was really her baby. But this one, Michael Paul Gonzalez is the guy who runs, or Monkey Wright, as he's known on the internet a lot. He runs Thunderdome. We say Thunderdome, but the site is Thunderdome with an A. And he put all that together. And those were his photos that we selected from.
That's great. And I was just bringing it up because actually I see that Nikki Gerlain was actually involved in it as well. And we're having Payla on next week. And we're having Nikki on in October. So.
I wonder if I said about Payla, if that'll be like proof of life, whether she listened to this episode or not. So you can bring up, do you want to respond to whatever Gordon was talking about you next week? And if she's like, what are you talking about?
That'd be great. We should definitely do that. I think we should take on this whole like thing where we just really try to confuse our guests.
Yeah.
And have awkward silences on the show. Yeah.
I can edit the awkward silences out. It's fine.
There we go.
She and I are fairly close, I would consider, as far as having an online relationship, so to speak. So
so there's another question. Same guy. And we mentioned we're really lucky. Not everybody can boast this kind of popularity, but we have exactly one fan of the show that isn't directly related to us in some way. I mean, some of the fans are actually related to us by blood.
You know, this reminds me of, in playing music, you would have you'd be playing a show and you'd have like just a handful of people in the audience. You would dedicate songs to individual people. Steve, this one's for you. You know,
right? Like last week, we dedicated a show to Rebecca Jones Howe. And we don't even know if she listened, to be honest. We did encourage her to listen to that episode. But yeah, most
I think
people
she listened to that one after I told her we dedicated it to her.
I hope so, right? the point is we have one fan that is not, we were born from Lit Reactor. He's not a Lit Reactor writer. He's not a friend or family member of any of the hosts. He's just a guy that likes the show, and we're really excited about that.
Well, he's
and
a
so
friend
the second,
of us now.
Yeah. Well, he's a friend now because he stroked our egos. But he submitted another question, WillStack70 on Twitter. He wanted to know how you felt about what he feels is a new movement of transgressive authors like the Pulp Years, and he included you, Richard Thomas, and a few others that are kind of emerging right now, and instead of bringing back kind of a grittier, different take on literature.
You know, it certainly feels like it. It's tough because I'm maybe a little too close to the center of that, and you know, there are certainly a lot of this is spawned, I think, by a lot of the communities and the online communities that have developed around these genres and whatnot, factions, if you will. And we're very supportive of one another. And as you've said, you'll often see several authors appearing in the same collections. And those circles, if you will, to use a Google term, often intersect. And like, so I have friends, you know, obviously in Lit Reactor from you guys, and there's The Velvet, and we've got Write Club and Thunderdome. And then you've got other people that are in like the kind of the HTML giant circle and the Rumpus and whatnot. And so I think sometimes it we're a little bit insulated, and it seems like that this is happening. I hope that's true in a larger sense, but it's really hard for me to tell. And then you've got, I'm thinking a Snubnose Press. There's a whole bunch of like neo-noir authors on that press that I like. The one thing that is kind of cool about it is, I mentioned this on another podcast that we did. It reminds me of like an independent record label and how a lot of them are more, I don't know, genre is not the word, theme is not the word, but there are certain presses now. I don't know if this was true in the past, but more in the independent world. If you're a fan of a press, you may like everything in their stable. Like Snubnose is one of those authors. I have like four or five books all put out by them because I know this is their taste. And if I like Anthony Neal Smith, I might also like, you know, this other person. And so, yeah, it was a little bit of an incestuous relationship sometimes because we're very supportive of one another. So it's hard for me to really tell, but to my eyes, it certainly does seem like there's been a wellspring or a groundspring. What is the term? I don't know. I need to consult my thesaurus. It seems like it, yes.
You say you hope that that's true, and I think for some of us that are below emerging author status who are just kind of struggling,
what?
We certainly hope it's true. Because that's the other thing. You know, I say this guy, he's great for us, right? Like maybe this one fan will be the reason that we continue doing the show. But
hopefully he has a lot of friends.
Right. Well, I just told him, I tweeted him, at WillStack70. That was for you, Gordon.
WillStack, we love you. Thank you so much for listening.
Yeah,
coming up next
on
the Nightlife,
he said. So he had made mention, you know, I posted something from my Facebook about the author that found a kid on Yahoo Questions or Yahoo Answers asking for a detailed review of his book so he could cheat.
Oh, yeah,
and
I saw that.
He read it, mm-hmm. And he responded to it. The author responded to the kid asking the question, and I had posted it up and said, you know, this the thing about writers is that we Google ourselves. And he and I were Twittering back and forth, if that's the right way to say it, and he had made some mention of the Lit Reactor movement then, as well as in when he asked us to ask you that question. And he sort of had this general feeling that anybody that's writing anything coming from there is going to be good. And, you know,
I love to hear that.
Yeah, well, I love to hear it because that's the workshop I'm using, right?
Yeah. You could say something similar about The Velvet and Write Club as well. Write Club especially. Write Club is, and it's a closed forum, so you have to be invited, and then, it's closed off from the outside. It's a private forum, but it seems like most of the talent that I've seen in my sort of intersecting circles of friends have emerged in one form or another from a version of Write Club over the last 5 years or so.
Yeah, and I think that's, I mean, I'm going to say what's really exciting about that to me is that we talk a lot, I think, people who pay attention to writing as more than a hobby, people who really put the time into it, talk a lot about how it's a very lonely thing. And if you're very, very lucky, you could find a group of writers that meet once a month or so and read their stuff to each other and do critique circles and everything. And that's if you're lucky. And that's if, you know, you're not the one guy who writes horror or the one guy that writes transgressive or whatever, right? But the internet is doing this really amazing thing. And we touched on this with Caleb J. Ross, where people blame the internet for a decrease in reading and writing, but what you see when you're kind of in it is that you get to do a lot of things that you wouldn't get to do pre-internet days. There wasn't an outlet for writers from all over the country that are interested in the same type of fiction to get together in one place and try and hone their craft together.
I like this a lot, this topic, and Caleb is an excellent source for this because he's a social media expert and an all-around great guy, despite what we may say on YouTube sometimes. But I look at my real-life friends that I've had for a long time, and we are friends mainly because of our shared experiences. You know, I grew up with these guys, and it's our shared experience and our geography that united us, and everything else had to kind of wedge its way into that over the years. And I found the older I get and we fall out of touch with those people, the internet unites people by interest, and that's far more interesting and lasting, and helps keep us together that way. And the internet is directly responsible for me personally having a newfound love of reading. I was on Chuck Palahniuk's site, The Cult, back in, you know, early days, like 2000. And I think my account says 2003, but they did something where you had to reset all the users at some point. And this has been very true of like the people in the Velvet, Write Club, whatnot. We actually get together in person a couple times a year. AWP is, that's what the Association of Writers and Writing Programs, something like that. They meet every year in a different city. I've been to two of them, and I plan on going to everyone from here out because it's not even about the conference. You know, there's panels from world-renowned authors and gatherings and whatnot, but we meet. It's an excuse for us all to gather, and we, you know, spend money out of our own pockets for hotels and flights. We hang out all week. Some people don't even attend the conference, and we just hang out and drink and go to restaurants and chill out, and, you know, we talk about writing maybe 10% of the time. You know, it's dick and fart jokes, right? it's a good time. And we met out in L.A., a whole bunch of us recently on our own dime, just went out just to hang out with one another because we're united by our interests instead of our geography.
Well, I mean, our show in general is, I've never met any of my co-hosts here in real life.
Three time zones, yeah.
Yeah, we're in three different time zones. I love when we have guests that are Central Standard Time, by the way, because that's where I'm at. Yay, Gordon.
Recognize.
But, yeah. CSD. But anyway, oh, God, we're so cool. This is why we don't have real-life friends. This is why we have internet friends. But
Is it 8:26 p.m. where you are as well?
Yes. Oh, my God. We're now united.
Oh, wow. Gordon just brought up a great point. I forgot to pay attention to the time today.
Oh, well, we're good. I'm watching the clock.
There we go. All right. Okay. Continue, Jessica.
But we've never met these people, but I consider them some of my closest friends, even though we have those shared interests, and that's what unites us. Yeah, so I see what you mean. I think that's an interesting point.
I wanted to go back to what you said about the internet reigniting your love for reading. I had to tell you, I think some people will be able to relate to this really well. I've always been an avid reader. I called myself a book eater. I would go through books like nothing. I almost failed a semester of college because I was reading what I wanted to read instead of doing college, right? But then, I got married, I bought a house, I had a kid. Sometimes I was working two jobs, sometimes one job with a lot of hours, whatever, and it's hard to motivate yourself to read. But I would definitely credit being a member of website Light Lit Reactor. Wow. That beer's hitting.
Like Lit Reactor.
Thanks.
.com.
For making me want to get out there. And one, I want to read the books that are coming out from the people in the community. And two, I want to read the stuff they're reading because I'm like, yeah, I like this guy. I like his writing. I'm probably going to like the books he's reading. And
they're
pre-qualified
a bit. They're tastemakers. If you like, you guys, there's a lot of crossover. You like a certain type of material. The recommendations they make, there's a 60-70% chance you're going to dig it as opposed to someone that, reads just like the bestseller list.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it's really great. I mean, and we can probably talk about that for hours. I think the way that public perception is not maybe reality with the way the internet is affecting people who love books.
If I can butt in for a second, thank you, William, for your questions, and Renee for being so good at taking the show. Gordon, I wanted to ask you, Flashover is an excellent novel so far, and I'm sure Major Inversions is as well. I was curious why you decided to go with print-on-demand publishing as opposed to traditional publishing.
I'm very impatient. That's the nutshell answer. First time around, like I said, I just kind of wanted to get a book done. But what I did was I got about a third of the way through that first book, and I was like, you know what? This is actually pretty good, I think. And, you know, I was reading some authors at the time, and it was kind of like sometimes you're inspired by if they can do this, so can I. And that's kind of how I was feeling about writing at the time. It's not that I was great, but I knew that I was as good as certain things that you saw on the shelf at least. And so I started taking it more seriously. And then I shopped that book around to agents at first, and then failing that, small publishers for over 2 years. And my frustration with that is, you know, it's a lot like the criticism that people have of self-publishing is that maybe the book wasn't ready for prime time and you released it anyway. I don't feel that way. A lot of people don't feel that way about their work, but I think by and large, that's probably true, you know. So that's why I released the first book that way. Print on demand, at the time, Kindle hadn't really, or ebooks hadn't really blown up. They were available. It was sort of bleeding edge technology, I guess you'd call it. So that seemed like the way to go for me eventually. I just kind of did it because I put way too much work into this. I didn't feel like it was a first book. A lot of people say you should just put the fucker in the bottom drawer and you know, it's like an abortion, you know, but never resurfaces in your life, right? That's twice I've mentioned abortion. I really apologize. sorry. But when the second book came around, I had a good experience, not necessarily sales-wise, but just with the ease of the publication process. I used CreateSpace, which is Amazon's imprint, if you want to call it that. And it was very easy, and I understand the process that – or they're involved, technically speaking. I used to do I still do graphic design. I used to do a lot more of it, print design and layout and whatnot at a job that I had. So I knew how to lay the book out and how to do the cover and all that kind of stuff. So I'm like, you know, why not do this myself? Editorially speaking, you know, maybe you could use some input. I did have some input from some people. Caleb J. Ross was an early reader of my work. Take a drink here right quick. And books and booze, yo. And so with the second book, I did a lot of workshopping. About the first half of the novel, I spent about 2 years on in Write Club, which was my workshop form of choice, and got great feedback. I implemented their changes and whatnot, selectively, of course. And just, you know, it appealed to me because I like having print books and ebooks both available. It's very easy to create an ebook. I write in an application called Scrivener. You basically hit a button and your damn ebook pops out, Kindle and EPUB. But to do the print layout is very challenging. It took me several days. And the artwork, I actually solicited the artwork from a friend of mine this time. I did my first cover completely by myself, photographically, in Photoshop. This time I had someone else do the artwork because it's a painting on canvas, which is now hanging behind me here in my studio. And then I finished it up with, you know, I laid over the title and I did the layout with the author's photo and the excerpt or the synopsis and all that kind of stuff. But I like having a print book. It just feels, there's a kind of a sense of validation. It's tactile. And there are still people out there that feel that way. I don't care. I just like to read. I don't care which format it's in. I have no, as you talked about in previous episode, I have no like fetishism of books, except that I like having my own on a shelf. That's really cool. And all my friends' books and all my colleagues and peers, if you want to call them, are all on one shelf very proudly. And, you know, you can burn it. It smells nice. I like paper books, but I also love the convenience of both. So I'm not snobby about either one. But for me, I went the pod route. One, initially out of frustration, and then two, out of impatience. It's like, look, I'm not putting myself through that whole publishing thing, the traditional publishing process again, and I want to get this damn book out. I've been working on it for 3 years as it is, and let's say I do have success. Even if I do, that's another 2 years. There's some dated references in the book. You know, let's just get it out there, and I just want people to read it, and I'm not looking for a big payday or anything like that. I'm more interested in people enjoying the reads and being available to them.
I want to touch on something because, well, first of all, it's great to know that you've actually listened to some episodes of the show.
you fans now.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many of our guests actually listen. I always encourage them to, but, you know. But one thing you said is we talk about the fetishism, and I got to say I'm probably the most vocal of the hosts on the show about having a fetish for books in hand. But as a part of doing this show, I have to read a lot. And I have to get the books really quickly. And you cannot beat the ebook format for that. Saying, okay, we just scheduled this person. They're going to be on in 2 weeks. I got to read their novel or reread their novel. And I don't live near a bookstore, and I don't have time to wait for it to ship from Amazon. I'm going to download that. And I read most of my ebooks on my phone, even. I have an e-reader somewhere tucked away, I don't know, but I do it on my phone because it's like I order it from my phone and it's right there. And so I got to say, agree with what you said about the fetish for the hard book on the shelf, get to look at it and drool over it and smell it and all of that, but it is really nice if you're having to read a lot or wanting to read a lot to have that.
You know, even on the author's end, if you're someone who wants to market themselves through short stories and novellas, your Kindle edition of your book goes up like the next day. I mean, if I write a book and I finish it and I do the print version, I got to get a proof and all that. Even now, it's majorly accelerated. I can have one out in probably 3 weeks or so if I wanted to, if I knew what I was doing. But an ebook, you know, you could put up a single, as they call them or whatever. I don't know if that's still the term or not. Literally overnight, and it's up for Amazon. And I can email it to you. If I'm doing a podcast, I'm like, yeah, here's my book. I know you guys need to review it in a couple of weeks, so here you go.
Right. Well, the thing about Kindle singles actually is it is slightly different because they have to approve those books. So I think it takes like 2 weeks. I know this because I recently got rejected by Kindle Singles.
Yikes.
But you can choose to self-publish, and if your self-published ebook through Kindle that you put up, you know, 24 hours later goes well, you can resubmit it to Kindle Singles, and they'll market it that way. So that's a really cool thing, I think, for emerging writers that are just trying to get their work out there and get it recognized.
Real quick, what's the guideline on Kindle Single? Do they look at, the word count? How do they know? How do they differentiate that from a traditional book? Do you know?
It's got to be – I can't remember the exact range, but I think it's got to be more than 5,000 words and less than – I'm going to say 50,000 words.
So it's based on word count in some regard?
Yeah, it's supposed to be short stories and novellas. And it looks like they have a really varied take on what genres are acceptable and what sort of writing is acceptable. When they rejected me, I got a form, so I don't know exactly what it was about mine that didn't work for them. But it's a really neat thing, and self-publishing through Kindle – I know a lot of people have had varied success with, but I think there's a certain amount of happiness that goes along with actually being accepted into a program and then seeing your name alongside some of the best-selling authors that have contributed to Kindle Singles. That's why I did it anyway. So,
I wouldn't know anything about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, they announced it, and I looked into it, and I went, hey, I got the story that fits the word count, and that's about as far as my research into it went, but...
Yeah, so I'll tell you guys why I'm broke, and I'll download the ebook version of, you know, whatever book, or if you know, somebody sends me their ebook version to review, or if they're coming on to our show, I'll do that. But if I like it, or, you know, if it's one of our friends or something from Lit Reactor, I'll also get the print book after I read it. So now I have like all of these double copies. And I'll probably never open the print book, but, you know, I just like having them, I guess.
I have that problem with some books. I recently saw a copy of The Great Gatsby that had a cover that I really liked. It was, you know, the regular cover, but it was just different than mine. And I desperately wanted to buy it. I didn't. I was really proud of myself for not, because, I already have it, and it's just the same book. But, yeah. I have that problem sometimes.
There's one particular book on my shelf, one title on my shelf that I have. The first edition hardcover, the UK ARC, and like three different paperback versions because of the cover art. It's my favorite book. I don't do that with a lot of books.
Which book is that?
Yeah, it's The Dark Half by Stephen King. I actually named my dog after the main character.
Gatsby,
wow. Something we've talked about offline elsewhere is this idea, and you're seeing people come around to it now. I believe, and I'm able to make this happen because I'm self-published, is to me, if you order a paperback version of a book, you should be able to get the ebook, the companion, for free. You know, like I think they should, you go to Barnes & Noble or whatever, they should print like, you know, here's an extra buck, print a code on my receipt or something that lets me download the Nook copy, or, you know, whatever. And so my policy is, if you just go to my website, GordonHineland.com, thank you, that if you buy a paperback copy of my book and you email me your receipt, I'll be happy to email you your choice of a free ebook, because you know, I just want people to read the thing.
And, you know, that's great, because and we've talked about this on the show, I don't know how many times, I collect first edition books, and I want them to stay nice, because they're, to me, they're collector's pieces. Some of them are worthless, but to me, they're special. And so one of the reasons that I got an e-reader in the first place was to have a reader's copy of my book that I wasn't going to have to lug across the country the next time I move.
Would you mind, can I take a one-minute pee break? Is that cool?
Yeah.
Can you edit that out?
Go for it, yeah.
No, we're
talk amongst yourselves.
You go on.
All right, I'll
be
back in a minute.
The part about you asking out, though.
Right, yeah, that's fine. You know, that's a challenge with having a podcast called Books and Booze. Those are two things that really make me want to go to the bathroom.
What is it
about Barnes & Noble? I walk in the bookstore and I suddenly have an urge to, yeah.
You know what it is? I'm going to tell you, I figured this out.
Oh, God.
Because if you're in the mall, because Barnes & Noble tend to be in malls, right? If you're in the mall, yeah. There's always like two bathrooms in the weirdest fucking places that are totally never anywhere where you need to actually use the bathroom. You walk into Barnes & Noble, you know there's a bathroom there.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, well, I better get it while it's hot.
I just thought it was
like
that association we had between
thing.
Reading and dumping, you know. But.
Yeah, that's what I thought we were going for there was the book by the toilet, but whatever.
Well, I've banned reading on the toilet.
I have a policy. The Kindle does not go in the restroom. That's a policy I have. You can take a paperback in there, whatever. I loan my books out to my friends. But the Kindle, you know, that's one device. You know, if a book is flagged, as they would say on the Seinfeld show back in the day, from having been in the restroom, imagine what your Kindle's like if, you know, one device that you take in there every day. No Kindles in the restroom policy at the Gordon Hineland household.
That's a good policy. I banned reading in the bathroom at my house because we have two adults and a potty training toddler and one bathroom. You need to get in, take care of your business, and get the F out.
Right.
I don't know.
All right, we're back.
CF, like we're on real radio, whatever.
Right. I do have an extensive radio background in case that is not apparent.
It is.
I don't, which probably is apparent.
That's all right. Next caller, please.
I don't even like to
listen. This is a great radio voice. Yeah.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
So speaking of radio, we were going to talk about your music a little bit.
All righty.
Oh, nice,
yeah, we had no question. We just expected you to say it.
Yeah.
Yeah, jump right in.
It began once upon a time.
Well, okay, so I'm not in front of my computer because much like drinking makes you need to use the restroom, it makes me need to smoke, so I'm on my back porch. But I did notice that you had a cover of Fiona Apple.
Yeah. You know, what's funny about that is I'm in a musical, I'm in a duo at the moment called Winebox, where we decided to strip things down and kind of do acoustic folk rock, you know, whatever, and a bunch of originals, which we're slowly getting around to. But so I needed to do a demo for, you know, club owners and whatnot. So we recorded some songs, a few of our own, a few other people's. And we did that one, and we host them on SoundCloud, and then we, you know, import them, embed them wherever they need to go, elsewhere online. And that song, for some reason, and it's even clearly said that it's a cover song, it's by Fiona Apple. We have, like, hundreds, if not thousands of hits on that one song by now. You know, we have, like, you know, several dozen on the other songs. But that one is, like, gangbusters. And I assume it's because they assume it's the original version, because, you know, my singer is awesome, and she does a great job. But it's the same thing with my cover songs that I post on my own website that I've been making for years, not so much these days as I did back in the day when I was kind of learning, feeling my way around the studio and whatnot. I would do other people's music. And those songs, I'd notice when I would check my Google Analytics or whatever, massive numbers of hits. And I think it's because people were trying to search for illegal downloads and whatnot. So I have this version, for example, of The Devil Went Down to Georgia that I transposed to play on the guitar, which I really thought was cool, from the fiddle to... Took me a while to learn that.
That was the other one I was to bring up, so yeah.
I had hundreds or thousands of downloads of that song. I'm like, there's no way. You know, nobody even knows who the hell I am. But this song and then some others, similarly speaking, that are cover songs, I think people are just looking for downloads. And so they just download them en masse, and I'm happy to oblige them. So I even went so far as to, like, change the names of the file names, you know, so they don't sound like that online. But the tag information, like if you download it and import it in iTunes, still says the right stuff. And maybe that's how they're finding these. I don't know. The ID3 tag.
I'll stroke your ego for a second. And I'll say that maybe part of it also is, I mean, I know I love to hear covers. I'm probably one of few people that will admit that openly. Everybody likes to talk about how you shouldn't fuck with good music, but I love to hear covers. My favorite band has a whole album of covers, and I love it. So maybe there's more people like me in the world that are just like, oh, Devil Went Down to Georgia on guitar? Fuck yeah, I'm going to download that.
People do like to hear songs they know.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like, you know, I came from the singer that's in my duo. We came up together in an 80s tribute band, and so we decided to carry on together after that fell apart. And it's a business thing. I live in Kansas, in the Kansas City area, and if you want to play the clubs, you play – there's two different bands. You know, there's the original bands and the cover bands. And the original bands are allowed to have the prestige and whatnot, but they're also at each other's throats all the time, and it's very competitive, whereas the cover bands get the business. So, you know, the clubs around here where you can play music, people will line up to play for free there. So it's really hard to get in any place. But the cover bands, they bring them in on the weekends, and they don't pay them that great. So we found that most of our gigs were out of town, like maybe an hour and a half or so out of town, because those places are more – entertainment starved, you know, out in the boonies, so they would pay to bring in entertainment, whereas the local places, you know, we feel privileged to be allowed to play there. So there was always this balance of like, are we a human jukebox, or are we making art here? And when we started the duo, it was kind of like, you know what, we'll do kind of right down the middle. Ultimately, our goal is to be an originals band, but we'll play covers, but they're going to be our favorite songs. These are our, you know, we do a lot of like kind of soulful music, and it's songs that you probably have heard two-thirds of, probably. I mean, you're familiar with probably two-thirds of the catalog, but then we can work in our own stuff, and it's not taxing our soul, because these are songs that we truly love and don't get tired of playing.
And that's what I was going to say. It was Jessica said too. People love to hear songs that they know, and I know it's hard to get stoked for the opening band when you go to a concert, because they might be like the best band you've heard in a long time, but you're like, I don't know any of the songs, I don't know what's going on, I'm just kind of waiting. But if they've got a couple cover songs in the set, then all of a sudden you're really excited, and then for some reason you're paying more attention to the rest of the music. It's like a
I want to say something really random real quick. I saw a band in Nashville. It was the opening act for Josh Ritter, but the band was David's Wax Museum or David Wax Museum, and the girl played a jawbone. I assume it wasn't a real jawbone, but it looked like one.
Yeah.
With a, like, and I was like, well, this
that was. I thought that was some obscure, like, exotic musical instrument I hadn't heard of, and I'm just nodding my head. Oh, yeah,
like
jawbone, yeah,
harp.
The Jew's harp or something, you know?
Yeah. No, it was, the jawbone of, like, a animal. I don't know what kind of animal exactly.
What kind of sound did it make?
Hint, creak, how do you make sound out of
it? Well, it's like a percussion instrument.
Okay.
Like, she had, like, a drumstick, and but seriously, we'll link it up. Renee, make note of this. We'll link it up on the show. Because it was charming. It really was. It was like this folk sort of sound. There was also an accordion going on. But, yeah, a jawbone.
So the bike.
Sorry, I have a new life goal.
And
to play
the molar is a D sharp, and the
the
premolar
is
an F flat. F flat. There's no such thing.
I'm going to master the jawbone. I just have to find one.
Well,
I
have a friend that can
right,
play a saw, like musically play a saw, and it sounds like music.
No one would ever believe you're from Kentucky.
Fuck you.
When I hear someone, when I hear a girl say that she's going to master the jawbone, that is not the first thing I think of. But
that's the
we're all about
loot.
The class.
I'm already a master. Thank you very much.
So, speaking of jawbone skills and saws,
really?
Gordon, I wanted to ask you, I'm kind of a nerd about this with music gear. What kind of equipment do you play on?
Like on stage or in the recording studio, if you will, or both?
Either.
Let's go both. Or... Why not? Yeah.
Yeah. There we go.
I have I live in an apartment, and I have a one room that's like a half bedroom that I've devoted to a studio, and there's a bunch of pictures of it up on my site in like the music gear section. But I basically have stripped down over the years. I have a whole lot of gear, and I own like 17 guitars, of which I play maybe three or four. I just can't bring myself to actually sell any of them. But by and large, what I play through for the music gear people out there, on stage, I play a Breedlove acoustic. I think it's called the Solo model. It has a sound hole in the side of the body of the guitar that points back up at me instead of the one that just goes out the front. So you would think that would really damage the sound, but it helps me hear myself better as well as the people out front. That's my main acoustic guitar. And then I also use on stage what's called a James Tyler Variax. And a Variax is a digital modeling guitar. It emulates the sound of other guitars digitally with various knobs and whatnot. And I plug that into a pedal board called a Pod HD500, which emulates amplifiers. And between the two of those, I hit a button on the foot switch, and it changes from a Marshall stack and a Les Paul to a Fender twin amp and a Telecaster at the push of one button. And it can change the tuning without me having to re-tune all the strings. So we do a couple of songs that are in open tunings and slide guitar and whatnot, and I just hit a button and all that happens. I use mainly that same thing in my studio, except I don't really – the Variax guitar is a little bit hard to play. You kind of have to wrestle with it a little bit. So in my studio, I'll pull from my regular guitar collection most of the time. And my baby that I play most often is a Paul Reed Smith Custom 22 with bird inlays and whatnot. It's beautiful. And I have an Edward Van Halen custom shop guitar. And a whole bunch of others, but the Paul Reed Smith and the Wolfgang are my primaries. And I usually do most of my recording through that same foot switch pedal board that I use on stage, and I run that into an input rack piece of gear that runs Pro Tools on a Macintosh computer.
I'm insanely jealous.
Oh, and I use a Yamaha S90 88 key synthesizer, and it basically plays like a piano. It has the same kind of weight in the keys as a piano does, and so it feels really good under your hands. I'm not getting endorsed from any of these fuckers, by the way, so send me the money.
Yeah, well, and writing off that, I was going to say, because we're not endorsed by anybody, which is bullshit, I think we should be, you mentioned a Macintosh computer. This podcast has been made possible by the MacBook Pro coming stock with GarageBand. So if anybody out there wants to give us money for that, they can go ahead and send me an email,
or
Renee at books-booze.com. and I'll tell you where to send the check.
Or if you would like to send me money to afford a MacBook Pro, that would also be very nice of you.
So we are getting short on time, which sucks, but it is what it is. We've only got an hour, and I hate editing out chunks of good conversation from our shows because I don't want to lose anything of what we've got.
So we just stop the conversation.
Yeah, just say, fuck it, we're done.
No more.
But we want to thank you from the cockles, the subcockles of our hearts.
The subcockle region.
The subcockle region. Really quick, we've got a few things, some business to attend to. This episode will be the first episode that is going to be released first on www.books-booze.com. We've decided to act like professionals. Well, no, we haven't decided to act like professionals.
We have a website.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got a website.
We decided to project the illusion of professionalism.
Right. That's right. Yeah. That's why you're published. You've got a great, great way with words. So make sure that you check us out on www.books-booze.com. This episode's also going to go up the same way we've been doing with a new episode on SoundCloud and all the links on Facebook. But we're going to start slowly moving away from that and putting all the important content on the website. Another thing we wanted to mention was if you haven't yet, you need to go out and not go out. You need to get on your computer and go to Insomnia Press and download issue 1. Because they're friends of the show. They made mention of us on their website. They're great guys. Dakota's got a book review and a short story in there, and I have a Twitter story in issue 1 we got.
A microfiction.
Also, find us on Twitter, at BooksBooze.
Yes.
I plan
BooksBooze with an S?
No, Booze, just Z-E.
BooksBooze.
Yeah, just all run together.
There's just no and in it.
I was going to spell it, but then I was like, wait, I don't know how, but I really do.
Wow.
It's BooksBooze with
right.
An at in the front.
Also, while you're at it, check out GordonHyland.com. He's a great guy.
Yes.
And
from GordonHyland.com, you can hit his blog. You can see where how to get his novels, where to read his short stories.
You can listen to his Fiona Apple covers.
You can. It has a link to his Last FM page as well as some music. And we always like free stuff. I happen to notice that there is a free download for a song called The Producer. So free stuff is always good. As Gordon mentioned, if you buy a paperback copy of one of his books, email him the receipt, and you can get ebook download for free. Once again, with the free stuff, Insomnia Press is also free. And Nova Parade at solarside.com is free, and you can also find Gordon Hyland's short story, Burgatory, there. And we're going to go out listening to a little bit of music from Winebox. So everybody have a great night. Check out the links, and make sure to listen next week. A shot of whiskey for the man's been far too quiet. Stomping at the Sheraton, hell raising at the Hyatt. Martinis to the souls from Cleveland to Shanghai. Not in Orleans, underneath the bourbon sky. It's till the night owls. Here's where the great moon howls. Celebrate this atmosphere and tip a pint of ice cold beer. Here's to our drinking pals. Guitar's going restless and the mic is running cold. Smoking set of rock ain't the only smoke we roll. You plug in and conjure fire. The house has gone electric and we're dancing on the wire. It's to the rock gods. It's to the iPod. I could shred my own throat or choke on the note. Send them up some of we'll be right back.
shrink and dial your phone. Last call tonight, won't see you going home alone. Cool out of closing time, will test libido's pride. Will she take a chance on after hours?
Or will the dude abide?